Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Poetry Salon Cast. I'm your host, Tricia Faye Hefner.
And I'm Kelly Grace Thomas.
On each episode, we interview one of our favorite poets to ask what got them started writing.
And what keeps them going.
And my favorite question, what do they do with a rough draft that wants to play rough?
Then we ask for advice that we, and you, our listeners, can use in our own writing practices.
Without further ado, welcome to this week's episode of the Poetry Salon Cast. Hello, Poetry Salon Cast listeners. Welcome to another episode of the Poetry Salon Cast. We are actually going to do something a little different this time around. Kelly and I realized that while we have been interviewing other poets, we haven't really taken the time to let the listeners get to know us. So today, Armine Ignatosyan, who was one of the first poets that we recorded with, is going to be joining me, and Armine and I are going to be interviewing the lovely Kelly Grace Thomas. Yay! Kelly Grace Thomas. So let's start out. Kelly, I'm going to ask you what we ask everybody on the Poetry Salon Cast, which is tell us a little bit about how you got started writing. And, you know, I also just, it occurs to me as I was preparing for this interview, like I've known you for like 7 years now, and I don't think I've ever asked half of these questions. So I'm really looking forward, really looking forward to getting to know this about you, yourself, myself. So, how did you get started writing poetry?
Oh, that is a great question. So it depends on how far back you go. I used to say that I had a hard time talking with my mother. I would get really emotional when I was young. And I used to write her these letters, these poetic letters, and shove them under her door.
That's horrible.
Instead of talking to him. So when I think about like the very beginning, I always think about that, about writing these letters, try to get my feelings out in a way that, you know, I felt like I could process and confront them. But I think the real diving in, I think like all poets, I flirted with it in high school, something that it felt great, but it wasn't until I had just turned 30 and I had just moved to LA, and I was approached by my principal to teach spoken word with a program called Get Lit, that they were looking for teachers to teach this curriculum and offering a grant. And I was extremely excited because I had seen spoken word through YouSpeaks, and it was something I wanted to do in my classroom to begin with. So I was excited to have a grant and a competition and a cohort of teachers that I could collaborate with. So I coached spoken word team for the first time ever. And I think this was it was the spring of 2012. And I was sitting with my students and we were going over their poems for competition, and they had only written like one or two each. And we had been like working on this stuff for maybe like 3 months. So I kind of said to him, you got to write more than this if you really want to get better at something. And during the time I was writing along with them, and I said, if you want to get better at something, you really got to do it every day. You got to practice. Being the English teacher, I was like quoting how Emily Dickinson wrote a poem a day. So as I was speaking, I kind of like heard that voice saying like hypocrite in my head. And I was, what are you, like, you don't write anything, like, you're not practicing what you preach. So I started writing more, and I went through some kind of personal struggles during that time, and I was feeling like I was on the verge of self-implosion. So I decided, as a way to kind of prevent that, of going, like, off the edge, that I was going to write a poem a day. And that kind of became a real practice of me like sitting down and every day being, okay, it's time to write. So I think then instead of some unhealthy habits, I started to reach towards poetry for a really healthy habit. And then I got really into it, and I met this awesome teacher and mentor named Tricia Faye Hefner.
Oh my God.
And that just kind of took it to the next level. And after that, I think I was just completely hooked. There was no way. I was like, oh, wait. People get together and they talk about these things. I was, yes. And Tricia, I just learned so much from you. Like it opened my eyes up to a whole new world. Which is just, once I started, I was like, okay, this is it. I'm all in and I'm just going forward.
Oh, thank you so much for saying that. That's so funny because you said, I met this awesome mentor, and I'm all like, oh, which of our Los Angeles poets is it? Who did you work with? Was it Sarah McClay? Was it Jack Grapes? You know, was, and then you said my name. I'm like, what? When did I become a poetry mentor?
Oh, yeah. So much. I mean, I think that probably at least half of what I know about writing, I learned from you. And I remember that when I first started writing, you were like, I think you should submit some work. And then I was thinking, how do you do that? So you will see in my early bio that I just opened up Poets and Writers Database, and I started with A. So it'll say like, Kelly Gray Thomas got published in Aries, Aduna, Aperion. I literally just, I didn't know what I was doing. So I just went with the first letter in the alphabet.
Yeah, I don't think I realized that before. And you know what is so funny? I guess it's really appropriate, but all three of us on this call are former English teachers.
Oh, you know? Appropriate.
I think there's something about when you're really good at English in general, at writing in general, those skills can transfer over to any of the genres you want. If you're already a pretty good English teacher, like you're going to pick up poetry a lot faster than you would be if, let's say, you were a math major. I mean, not to try to denigrate math teachers, but it's like you're using a lot of the same machinery, the same brain machinery to write a poem as you are using it to like write an essay or a short story or analyze a short story. So you had a background in journalism before you came to teaching English. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I went to school actually for, it's called Writing Literature and Publishing at Emerson College, and I had a fiction emphasis. So I wrote fiction up until the age of 30, pretty much. And I don't know if I felt that I quite had the passion, although I always say that poetry is like an affair and fiction's like a marriage. So fiction is a lot more of a long-term commitment. You can't just go in and flirt around for a day and then like leave. So I graduated college and my number one goal was just to get paid to write. I was like, how can I get paid to write right now? And someone's like, well, you could write a book and then get it published and find an agent and blah, blah, blah. And it'll probably be 3 years. And I was like, nope, I got this free. I need to make money. So I actually started as a freelance reporter. I wanted to get a job as like a journalist. They wouldn't hire me because I didn't have any experience. So I asked them if they had any other jobs available, and they had an opening in the classified department. So I actually worked at that newspaper in the classified department. And every time they said, I need a reporter to write this story, I would just say, I'll do it. I'll do it. I figured that way I wasn't in their face, like they couldn't ignore me. And it worked out really well, actually. I became a full-time reporter and then assistant editor and an editor.
Wow. So you've been doing the writing for quite a while. It wasn't until you were 30 when you switched from prose writing into the poetics, into poetry.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I've always loved words and always been obsessed with them. But I don't think that I had ever like kind of given myself the full rein to fall in love with language as much as I am enamored by it. And I think that poetry gave me that opportunity.
So what have been your earliest influences?
So I was really obsessed with the Beats for a very long time. I read Howl, and it was unlike anything that I had ever read in my whole entire life. And I always said that, funny enough, that I live in the Bay Area because I was obsessed with all the beat writers. I came to visit San Francisco. I even have a book that's the Beat Literature Walking Tour where I could walk to all the different places where all these poems and stories were written and kind of track them down. So what I loved about Howl was that it just like it really it ran wild with language in a way that I hadn't seen before, in a way that mimicked my internal experience. So
I love that.
That's one of the things that poetry can really do, is that it mimics emotion and experience, and it gives you the essence of that so well in that fiction, like you build this really neat house with the scaffolding and the roof and you put the curtains on. And I feel like poetry sometimes is just taking a sledgehammer to the walls.
Yeah, you know, that's a really good way of describing it. And of course, Howl very much mimics the internal experience. Like I often walk down the street and think, I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, running through the angry streets at dawn, looking for an angry fix. I'm not quite that articulate, though. But yeah, it just runs wild with language. And I've been reading books lately and just feeling like even the best prose books that I read, I'm just like, oh, come on. No one talks like this. This is so constructed. This just feels so fake. You're like writing a novel. You're not really being real with me here. You know, like I think I've gotten a little bit spoiled with poetry in that sense.
And I think that there's a difference between building the arc of a story and character development as opposed to poetry just being like, I'm in it. Sit next to me while I tell you about that.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm curious, Kelly, did you ever try to write a book prior to writing poetry?
Yes. I've written a novel and I'm halfway through another one.
Wow.
I started the first novel, I want to say, maybe it was around the same year. I came back from Barcelona, so I lived in Spain for a while, and there's this quote by Benjamin Franklin that I have kind of lived my life by, and it's that you either need to have a life worth writing about or you have to write something worth reading. Mm. And I always say that I spent the first 30 years of my life having a life worth writing about, and I'm spending the next 30 years trying to write something worth reading.
Mm.
So I wrote my first novel. It's called The Travis Bannister Conflict. And I just wanted to make sure I could write a novel. And I could. I don't know if I could write a fantastic novel, but I could write a novel. It just kind of sits on my desktop and keeps me company. I know that it's there. I know that I did it. Yeah, I'm working on a YA thriller right now that I'm about halfway through. I took a long pause because there was a lot of stuff I needed to do for my forthcoming collection, so I kind of needed to shift the focus on that, but my goal is to get back to it come August.
And how many poetry books have you written?
Only one. I have a collection coming out with Yes Yes Books. It's the title of the book is called Boat Burned, and it is coming out December 2nd, 2019. So
fantastic.
Yes, it should be available for pre-order in October. So we are
around the corner. That's like 3 months away.
Yes, for the pre-order, absolutely. So it's all really exciting.
Oh, very cool. Questions
on that one.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about that one that's coming out soon and what it's, if there's a theme or a focus.
Yeah, so the title is Boat Burned. It's kind of a weird origin story of how this manuscript was born. So I had a collection of poems that I was obviously sending out that weren't ready. They were all connected. I couldn't quite point to the unifying thread of what that connection was versus besides the idea of womanhood and my experience. So I was in a Korean day spa. And if you're not familiar with those, a lot of times the women are completely naked.
I've been to one. Yeah.
Yeah, they're wonderful and very relaxing. So a lot of times I would lay there and be meditating or just exhaling a much needed rest, and a poem would come to me and I would put on my robe and go write on my cell phone. So this particular day I was getting undressed and I was like thinking, what if underneath our clothes, all of us women were something different than a human body? Like, what if I took off my clothes and underneath I was X? So in my head, I'd be a boat. Then I just like sat down and I wrote this poem called The Boat of My Body, and thinking about like comparing really like the overarching view is looking at the way that we can use metaphor to express and reckon with the way that women's bodies have been objectified or looked at it as a piece of ownership other than ownership, like the idea that we struggle with ownership ourselves. It's the idea of taking the idea of women and my idea of femininity and the idea of a woman as a boat, burning it down and rebuilding it. So Sun Tzu has this quote that is, once you cross into enemy territories, you burn the bridges and you burn the boats to show that you're never going back. So collection is really a burning down of what I once thought it meant to be a woman and what that experience is like, and talking myself out of never going back to that.
Very cool. I love that whole concept. And the idea that boats and cars are usually she's, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So there's so much. Once I started doing the research, I also grew up on a boat. So when I was little, I used to race sailboats. My dad owned a sailboat and went through a bankruptcy where my parents were separated, but he lost everything, was evicted from his house, had no possessions left. My family lost everything, and the only thing he had left was his boat, and he relocated to Florida from New Jersey, and we spent a month living on it and sailing down to Florida with him to say goodbye. So that also has like a huge influence on the manuscript and obviously my parents' relationship and what that process was like. But when you look into it, there is so many comparisons of women and boats, the quotes that you can read about it will just turn your stomach about how they felt. A man at the helm to control them, and they look better with a lot of paint on them. And, you know, up until a certain point in history, boats were always named after women, but women weren't allowed on boats. Like, it was something to be unheard of. Very complicated relationship.
Kelly, you've got to see this movie. It's called Maiden. It's about the first ever all-female-run boat race. I mean, it's a boat race that happens every year, but it's about the first all-female-led crew that competed. And I was listening to the interview with the woman who was the captain of the ship, and I totally blanking on her name, but she talks about the different way the women ran the boat and how it was different from the men running the boat. And like, the men never talk, whereas the women, it's like, there was not a thing. We didn't know about each other by the end of that voyage. And everyone thought this was like the 80s too. This wasn't just like 100 years ago. This was the 80s. And nobody thought women could run a boat. It was crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It is such a kind of a gentleman's, or even just like even the idea of the Navy and military, and this is kind of like a man's land, and that's it.
Yeah, yeah.
I wanted to go back to what you said about when you were at the spa and you got an idea and you went and put on your robe and got your cell phone out and wrote it down. Are you that disciplined with... like, if you're driving and you come up with ideas, do you do that too? Because I know a lot of writers don't. And that's the big difference between being prolific and having great poems sometimes and not having as much stuff, is that we're constantly writing in our heads. We just have to write it down.
I am not a poster child for safety, so... I will be known to be in LA traffic, or even I used to commute a lot from Los Angeles to the Bay to be on the five, and a poem comes to me and I'll write it down. Stephen King says he never keeps a writer's notebook because the best ideas don't leave you alone. I think the best ideas you hear super loudly, like so loudly that you can't really ignore them. Mm-hmm. And for me, if a poem comes so clearly, it's such a gift that to refuse that gift, in my opinion, would be like stupid. Yeah. So whenever I have inspiration really strike, I usually try to stop whatever I'm doing if I can. Obviously, if I'm, you know, in a work meeting, I can't do that. But as much as I can. I had a medical procedure done the other day and I sat in the parking lot, wrote a poem about it because it was such an odd experience. And, you know, it was like this experience that the technician and I, it was a young woman and she was like, no one talks about these things. And we were just sitting together and she's like, why don't we talk about these things? And this is such an intimate moment between me and this stranger, but two women both being, it wouldn't be so lonely if we could all just kind of have a conversation. So I felt very inspired by that moment and sat in a parking lot.
That's really cool.
You know, you said something else too, Kelly, about the first half of your life, you had something to write about. And so the second half you're writing about that. I think kind of anyone who's lived through a childhood has an interesting story to tell. And I would even say like anyone who's lived through any life experience has an interesting story or series of observations or emotions to tell. I mean, we're all so incredibly different, and yet this idea of becoming a person and just having to grapple with the things that we all grapple with between birth to death it could give you plenty of interesting fodder if you took the time to investigate it and be interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I know with your work, your first book came out or is coming out, and that was a lot about the idea of being a woman. And I've read it. I've read each poem probably several times. I can tell a lot of them are about your younger experience, but you're continuing to write about your current experience now. So, you know, I have a feeling your next book is going to be about your 30s, and you're just going to keep writing about what's going on in your current life.
I think that for me, writing helps me really process that. Yeah. I usually come to the page because I'm like, this emotion is kind of like this thing that's on my back that I can't get off no matter how much I like twist and turn. And then the writing process kind of helps me accept it or carry the weight in a way that it feels more manageable. I also think that I go to the page to like, I'm much braver in poems than I am in real life.
Mm.
So I think a lot of times I go to write a poem because I'm scared and I want to feel like I'm a little more powerful than I'm making myself out to be in the day to day.
Yeah, I think that's a really important reason why a lot of us come to poetry. It's like, you know, you may not be able to change everything in your real life, but you can change the way that you look at it or the way that you tell the story about it. I mean, just even the act of writing itself is a way of taking power over the situation. You know, my background is in psychology of creativity. So there's a lot of research on that, which is why I love teaching creative writing workshops. Because I'm like, even if a poem doesn't get published or some of the poets we work with don't necessarily wind up winning NEA grants or Guggenheim fellowships or whatever, like if they write something and they feel a little more empowered about their own life, I'm like, that's a big payoff on its own. And if they happen to get it published, I mean, that's just like bonus points.
Well, I want to add, Tricia, that yet they haven't won one yet.
Yeah,
they will.
We're all on our way to winning Guggenheim.
They're all published.
What are you talking about?
They're published in so many great journals from what I saw in the anthology you put out.
Yes. Yeah. They are.
Which is also available at.
You can also order on Amazon.
But, so cool. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
It's know like that?
5-6 years of Poetry Salon.
Yeah.
Kelly, I wanted to piggyback on your writing practice now where you stop. And has it changed over the years? Like when you were in your 20s versus 30s, has your writing practice changed at all?
I think I'm so much more disciplined than I used to be. I am an Aries. So Aries work really well with goals. Mm-hmm. And if I have a goal, I can work like nonstop. That I'm really kind of like drive forward. I would work all day, get home at like 7 or 8 and then have dinner and like sit and write until like 11 when I was working on this book. Because I had a deadline that I had in mind and I was really trying. Because I was a semi-finalist for Yes Yes's Pamet River Prize, which is an excellent prize. It's for female-identifying and non-binary writers. So I was a semi-finalist. So in my mind, I was that much closer to the finish line. Really, like, pushed myself during that time. I think that I write in spurts that I will go through a really prolific time and I'll write a pretty long break. I kind of call them harvests or crops. Mm-hmm. So once I have like these 10 or 20 poems, 20 is being generous. Once I have like 10, 5 or 10 poems, I will polish them, send them out, and maybe recharge for a little bit. I think that in the past, I assumed that this time was just like me not writing. But now as I get older, I see like the importance of the recharging and not burning out. And also like the perspective on whatever subject matter you're looking at it. Because if you're writing a collection about a specific subject matter, you might have a real different view, even like 6 weeks down the line than you did when you first wrote that, the first poem on that subject matter, if you're examining like one particular thing.
Yeah. So
it's super erratic, to be honest. I'm that person who's always like, I'm going to get up at 6 a.m. and yeah. work for 3 hours. And I know people who do that. And I am yeah. like, praise to you. That's amazing. I unfortunately like don't have the work schedule or like financial freedom to be able to do that at the moment, but I'm switching jobs a little bit right now. So I hope to have more of a consistent practice in the future.
Yeah. I've always been in between those two schools because I've had mentors who've told me both. I've had mentors who said, write every single day, like that book, the artist's way, right? Yeah. A lot of people follow that. And then I've had mentors who are like, no, you're always writing in your head, mm-hmm. whether you write it down or not. And it's okay to let it incubate and then have a burst of writing come out. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. You know, I love hearing different writers talk about their different practices because I think some writers can get very adamant that their way is the best way. And like I took a workshop with Tony Glogler, who's an amazing poet and fairly prolific, I'd say. And he says he doesn't write every day. He waits till he has inspiration for a poem. And then he kind of works that poem out in his head until he knows exactly how he wants to write it. And then he writes it down. And he's written some amazing poems and he's gotten a couple of books out. So I'm not going to say that there's anything wrong with his way of writing, but oh my God, is that not the way that I write? That is like the exact opposite of the way that I write. And I don't think I would trade my writing practice for his, but it just goes to show you that there are different ways and they can have similar results. And if anyone tells you like there's only one way to write a poem, just stick a hot poker up their butt.
Yeah, no, totally.
They don't know anything.
I once heard someone say, if someone asks you advice on writing and if the person's response, if you ask someone, and their response is to just write every day, that person does not give a shit about you. That's like the most blanket thing that anyone can say, well, write every day. Well, I don't know. I can tell the difference in my writing when I'm actively reading and when I'm not. And when I'm actively reading a lot, I just write better poems. Yeah, like it's that simple. I write better poems. So I also go through reading spurts where I'll read like 3 or 5 books and then I think I process for a little bit. One thing I do, Armine, is I will have the first line for poems a lot. So I will write the first line in my notes on my phone. I have the first line of like maybe 15 poems at the moment. If I have time to write and I'm like, oh, okay, cool. I've made some time to write this morning. And if nothing comes to me, then I go to those like starts.
That reminds me of Ray Bradbury's practice. Someone told me, and I read it somewhere, that he would have different notebooks laying around his house, his garage, his backyard, his bathroom, with different stories starting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wherever he was, washing dishes, or if something inspired him, he would go ahead and write in that notebook. Brilliant way.
Sometimes I just write a couple lines and I leave that poem again. It's like the idea of like an old friend being like, I'll be here. Like, don't worry. I'll be here. Just come back when you're ready.
Yeah. I also want to say for those folks listening who just have terrible memories, you know, I know you had said, I think Stephen King said, like, don't, you know, you don't have to write it down because if it's a good idea, it'll stick with you. And I think Richard Hugo says something similar in The Triggering Town. It's like, you don't have to write it down because if it's really good, it'll stick with you. But just for those of us who don't have the greatest memories or are easily distracted by things, like, I would say I have come across some really good ideas in my notebook that I didn't remember I'd written down. And I was really grateful I did write them down because I'm like, this is a good idea. And I forgot about it as soon as I was done having the idea.
It's like Nikhil Davis insists in workshops when someone says something out loud and it's amazing, she'll tell them, write it down right now. Because we don't. She says it doesn't count until you write it down.
Yeah, and there's a lot of research on the act of writing something down. Even if you like forget where you put it, like the fact that you wrote it down is going to help you remember it later on in a way that's different from just reading it or just thinking it without writing it down. So
I have a list of write a poem about blah, blah, blah on my phone, on my notes. Write a poem that ends with the word illumination, like random writing prompts for myself. Kelly, you said that the first line or two come to you. With me, it's usually the last line that comes first.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Has that ever happened to you or Tricia? Has that ever happened to you where you're like, oh, this is the end line. Now I have to work towards it.
Yeah, you know what? That's actually funny because that's very much my way of writing, too, is like I'll usually do a brain dump or whatever until I get to a really cool ending line. And then I'm like, oh, that line's really cool. And then I have to write an entire poem. I have to construct a poem that sets up the ending line.
Yeah, that's hard. That's really hard to do, I think, for me.
Yeah,
it's very difficult for me. I think that my last lines usually show up somewhere in the middle of the poem, but I don't think I've ever had in my whole entire life a last line show up, which is interesting.
I tend to do things backwards in general. So.
Yeah, I don't think I hardly ever know how poems are going to end.
Really good. I mean, we shouldn't technically, I don't think it's really good to have an agenda. But once in a blue moon, it'll happen. Where I'm like, yeah, I know how to end this.
Well, that moves us on to our next subject. We're going to take a very quick break. And then, Kelly, I'm going to ask you to read a poem that was easy, that came easily, and a poem that you worked really hard at. And then we're going to ask you to explain what you did to wrestle your rough draft, wrestle with the angel.
We'll get back to our interview in just a moment. In the meantime, if you want to get more support for your own writing or learn more about the craft of poetry, check out our services at www.thepoetrysalon.com. You can learn more about poetry by taking one of our e-courses or get feedback on your own writing by joining one of our editing classes.
The Poetry Salon is a community of intrepid writers who support one another through in-person and online services.
One more time, that's thepoetrysalon.com. You can also reach me directly with any questions that you have at tricia@thepoetrysalon.com.
Now, back to our podcast.
All right, so without further ado, Kelly, take us away with two of your poems, and don't... Don't tell us which one came easy and which one came hard. Let us guess.
Okay. This first poem is called Closer. My father left us like weather. My mother sunk next to the dock. Us daughters tried to swim, became driftwood in the backyard. I am still somewhere, stuck at 10. Trying to call a shipwreck home. The past scolds, look at her, blue burnt and barnacled. I washed my mouth out with waves. Closer, it says. Her fiberglass dress, she itches. Memory blooms a rash I scratch to bleed. History is a dirty ocean. And I am dangerous with thirst. Most days I schooner. Wait, nets empty. I can't wind the strength. Most nights I drink. Story or language. I can't keep either down. Mm. So that's the first poem.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is how you write an extended metaphor poem. That rocks.
Thank you. And this one is called Burn the Boats, and it is the title-ish piece. Because I believed somehow it was my fault. I never told anyone how my great-grandmother pinched the extra chub around my waist and asked, "Who will keep you now?" Pointed to every empty man not at our table. Told me I'm only as good as what I can please. Hunger, my only harbor. I carried this, a body full of broken boards and boundaries. I never told anyone how my first love dropped threats like an anchor. Warned me what would happen if I took on water. Sinking always slipped between his speech. I believed being boarded equaled boat, so I floated. For 7 years, subtracting what I had for another body, parts of me that couldn't fit inside his hands. My first love never let me use his front door. Instead, gave me a dark portal to climb through. I only remember this. In bed, he would measure the circumference of my thighs, then beg for less. I became the smallest vessel I could steer. Every day he climbed through my story until I gathered enough distance to choose another name. I can't turn back. I strike a single match, burn myself brighter. The boats that built me smoke on shore. That's it.
All right. Wow. So talk a little about both of those. Which one of them came easiest, and to what do you attribute the ease with which it came out?
Yeah, quickly and easy was Closer, the first poem that I read. And I would say out of all my poems, half come easy and half are a struggle. So it's pretty balanced combination. Mm. And what I attribute to Closer coming easy is that I was actually at AWP. I was in Tampa. And
I was there.
Yay! Great. It was great. So I stayed at a hotel that was like on the water, and I got to take this lovely like 5 to 10 minute walk every morning to the convention. And, you know, I was walking and all of a sudden like this line just came to me, and I think I wrote that poem within 5 minutes. The poem was really a response to, I was in a workshop with someone, an online workshop, and I was writing about my family situation and my, you know, the boat trip that we took. And this person in the workshop was like, I don't understand. Why would your parents be together if they were separated? And none of this makes sense. Like, she just was so rigid on her idea of what divorce meant, bankruptcy meant, what boats meant. I mean, so many people are like, oh, if you're on a boat, you must be rich. And I'm like, I don't think you're hearing that this was the only possession my family had left. So people are so rigid in their idea of what they think something should look like, and they're so greedy for the facts that
they
know exactly how it happened. And I've written those poems that do say exactly how they happened, but they don't always have the charge or tension that I feel makes a poem a poem. So that idea of most nights I drink story or language, I can't keep either down, meaning like I can tell you exactly what happened, or I can make you feel it, but I have a hard time doing both.
Yeah.
And giving you the facts, I don't know if they're beautiful. So it was really in response to that. And I think I was just walking and it kind of came to me, and I was, oh, this is great. And I attribute to me thinking, having the privilege to be at AWP. I work as the director of education for Get Lit Words Ignite, which is a spoken word youth poetry nonprofit. And so I was presenting for them. So I have the privilege of being at AWP and my employer sending me there. And I had the privilege of, sometimes we don't always have 15 minutes to reflect silently. And this time I did, and I was really like reflecting. And I think that it's in those moments of quiet that my brain is, you have something to say about this. But sometimes the email keeps dinging or the phone keeps ringing, and my brain doesn't always get that chance to speak up because other things are louder. So I attribute it to one being like super immersed in poetry and reading and beautiful language. For me, whenever I'm in those situations where I'm in poetry for like 2 weeks, the poems just flow out of me because it's all my brain is, it's like attuned to.
I think that's fantastic advice. And I dare anyone who is really scientific minded to count up how many of your poems, what percentage come to you while you're in movement of some kind. Because I think that's such a valuable experience. You know, you surround yourself by poetry or you work on something for a while and then you go for a long walk or you go for a long drive or you do something where you're moving, you know, you scrub the floors and that's when the work comes to you. You know?
Yeah. It's pretty amazing how much, well, they say that we really struggle as humans with our left brain and the logic and the language and all of these things. And then if we would just kind of shut up our left brain, our right brain has most of the answers, which is, you know, our feeling and our intuition, but we're so dead set on being able to do it ourselves and work it out. So I think that giving it that space and then going to something else, it's like when you can't think of a word in a conversation, you're like, oh, what is that word? It's driving me crazy. And then you end the conversation, and you're like, bam, this is it, because you're not focusing on it anymore.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Which I think is just a lesson in life, one that I'm learning very slowly.
Let it go for now.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then, what made it the poem, the second one, more difficult than Closer? And how did you keep going?
That's a great question. So one of the things is after examining this idea of the state of womanhood or the way that I woman that I did not like, that comes from submissive, it comes from apologetic, it comes from feeling that the power lies outside myself. I was really examining where that came from. If you're going to burn something down, you also have to understand what built it. I was in a workshop with Jericho Brown last summer, and I had, this was the opening poem to the manuscript. And Jericho is a very, he's a poet who I think, like every time you're in workshop, he has someone read their poem out loud, and then the person to the right has to explain the dramatic situation. So what are the facts? What do we know is going on in the poem? And I like was thinking about this poem, and it was very interesting, but it was a lot of mixed metaphors. It wasn't very clear. There was like raw emotion behind it, but it was really messy, and it was emotional. So I think that sometimes when things are so emotional, there's everything in there, right? It's like, there's like sadness and there's anger and there's guilt and there's shame and blah, blah, blah. It was like a succotash of emotions and metaphors. So then he wrote like all over my packet on this poem, what the hell is this? Question mark, question mark, question mark. And I was just, oh man, this is my opening poem.
That must have worked.
Yeah, and it was, I think this was August 2nd, and my manuscript was due September 1st.
Wow.
So I sat, and I was like, this sounds horrible, because it's not like a blame game, right? I think that if you feel like you don't have any power, that's the work that you have to do yourself, because you've given that power to someone else. So I can't say, like, these people are responsible for this, but I was thinking, who did I give away my power to? Like, what are my earliest memories? And for me, I really like came to two names, and it was one, like my first relationship that I was ever in was an extremely psychologically abusive relationship. Mm-hmm. It took me a really long time. It took me like maybe 6 years out of that relationship, as I was telling everyone, yeah, I'm just never going to be in a relationship again. I'm not sure why, but I don't want to do that ever again. You know, it took me 6 years to realize what that was. And also thinking about, I think that especially in the light of women empowerment, which I think is so important and so wonderful, that sometimes there is a lot of conversations around the way that men have objectified our body or owned it or done something to take away our power. But I also have very clear memories of the women in my family doing the same thing to me. Women saying like, you need to be thin or you will not have a husband, or just like straight up as like a 5-year-old kid telling me I was fat and gross. You know, I was like a chubby little kid. I was a chubby little kid. And that really just shaping my body image for the next 25 years. So thinking about what made me believe that I was kind of this powerless thing, this powerless, really hurt thing. How can you know the direction that hurt you to turn into go take a new path or a new journey? So it took me a lot to get to this. Tricia was also really helpful. She was also like, what does this mean to burn the boats? What does it mean to burn something down? And what is the old idea of who you were and where are you moving to? And I think that where are you moving to is a difficult one in process. Hashtag in process. I can definitely look at where I was and the situations that really launched these identities and self-image.
Well, yeah. I find it interesting that Jericho Brown wrote, you know, what he wrote, but he asked a question, and I think...
Oh, yeah, awesome. And I was so grateful for that feedback.
He asked a question.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And that's what Tricia does, and I think good teachers do that. They ask you questions more than direct you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's part of being a good reader, too.
Yeah.
And craft, I think about this a lot, too, because I think there's a lot of argument in the poetry therapy community about not getting too much into craft because you want people to express themselves. And for me, learning a craft is really just about asking certain questions like, yeah. What was the imagery in the room with you at that point? Or can you put this as a metaphor? What did it feel like? Or can you say more about this? If you're expanding a poem, can you say more about this? Or if you need to say less, what's the most important part here? These are all just valid, valid questions that happen to make the artwork better. And I feel like if you use the craft the right way, it can direct you to an emotionally significant experience. I think a really good poem is a form of really good therapy, and a form of really good therapy will lead to a really clear, more evocative poem. Yeah, and I hear that with you, Kelly. I think that's such an interesting and insightful question to be asking yourself as a person and the poem itself, which is, where did this idea come from? Who did I first give the power to? And then investigating that as the poem. You know, and it kind of makes me think, too, about, like, what is it we're doing here with our writing? We're doing these things where we are investigating our own lives so that we can get insight into our own lives, but we're also giving that insight to someone else, too. Now I'm going to go home and I'm going to think about, who have I given my power away to, and all the ideas that will percolate after that. So that's just really fantastic gift you can give to your readers.
Yeah, I also want to just add to that. And I think that Jericho Brown is one of the best teachers I've ever had in my life. But I think the best teachers want what's best for the poem.
Yeah.
And they push it in a way that other teachers or feedback or peers, that they don't push it. That they push it to its highest potential. And I don't think that this poem was being pushed to its highest potential.
Right. So let me ask you a couple other questions, because first of all, I just find this fascinating that you had the book accepted and you had a publication date before the book was even finished. For me, is an insane amount of pressure to have on a book, because the way that I write, you know, I don't send something out unless I think it's finished, and I dawdle a lot.
It was finished, but how Yes Yes Works is like, your book gets accepted, and then you have like however much time to work on revising if you feel like poems can still be better. So it was like finished as it was like a complete manuscript, but the poems definitely have gotten tighter over that past 2 years.
Kelly,
got it.
Did you work with an editor to revise, or was it all on your own?
So I'm really
like with
grateful for their process. So KMA Sullivan, who is a brilliant poet and the publisher of Yes Yes Books, I worked with her one-on-one, and we went through, I think, 3 drafts of the manuscript.
Oh, wow.
So what happened is I would hand in my manuscript, she'd give notes, we'd have a phone call, talk about it. A month later, I'd hand in a revision, we'd go over it. So there was a whole process around editing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very, very supportive.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I didn't have that at all with Main Street Rag.
Yeah, a lot of publications don't. Yeah. And for me, again, I'm so grateful because I think that some of these poems could have been like they were not at their highest potential. Mm-hmm. So I think now I want to say they all are. You know, but like as like a person who's just a little anxious about their first book. But yeah, I think they're all the best that they can be. But it was definitely like a collaborative effort of a dialogue back and forth.
That's great right. for writers to know about presses.
Oh, how, yeah.
What the writer's experience was.
And like. I think that that's a really important question to ask. I think that one of the things that happens with poets, I don't know so much about fiction, but people are just so, oh, I want my book to get published or I want to win a prize. But they don't always consider how that press is going to help edit and package and promote your work, which I think is so important to know.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Let me ask you a little bit then about this book, this poem specifically. Did you know that you wanted this to be the first poem in your collection before you even started it? Prior to even getting feedback on it, what was the genesis of this poem?
So no, what I did was once I was like semi-finalist for Pamit, I laid out all the poems on my writing office floor and I looked for gaps where there were things that were important in the manuscript that weren't addressed, or what I call linchpin poems. They are the poems that kind of hold the sections together and hold the collection together. So I think that if you're looking at a collection and it's divided up into five sections, each section can kind of have like their main poem, that if you took those five main poems, it would be like a great representative of the entire collection.
So
I thought that this poem was definitely one of those five main poems. I also read the piece of advice from Tiana Clark in Poets and Writers, and who is a fabulous poet. And I don't know who told her this, but it was like advice on your first book. And she said that the last poem in the book should be the book. And I was like, whoa, which is interesting because that's what happened with the editing through Yes, Yes. Although that statement had not been articulated to me, but that's what it was. So when it came to Burn the Boats, the word boat burned, that I am boat burned, came to me in another poem, and I wrote it down. I think these are called portmanteau, that when you combine two words, I have a few stylistic device, whatever, that's just like my style that I do, and that is one of the things that I do throughout the manuscript. So I liked this idea of boat burned, and it was one word, and the title was originally one word, and then I separated them out because I didn't like how it looked. It felt crowded. But then I had that idea of boat burned in this other poem. It was just a line, and it was just a word in the line, and I kept on just saying boat burned. And I had this quote by Sun Tzu, and I don't even know where I read this quote. I've been like having this quote in my pocket for so long, and it's been so important to me, and I don't know where I found it. I will tell you that they do say, I've read blogs and stuff that just say burn your boats. And it's not burn your bridges. Burn your bridges is usually about like friendships and relationships. I think like burn your boats is more like there's a difference, me just being like, you're all in. This is the only world that you have to make your own, or it's ruin. It's this or ruin. So I thought, okay, I need to have a poem that at least addresses this. Like, what am I talking about and where is it coming from?
Yeah.
And did the poems get written before the concept of the book was realized? Or did you think of the concept and then write towards that?
Yeah, I would say maybe 30-40% of the poems were there already. But once I got the concept, I started rewriting a lot of stuff. So I would say that I probably wrote maybe 40% of this book in like 2 months.
Whoa.
I was like, okay, now I know what this is. Cause I was trying to meet one deadline and then I knew, and then I was trying to meet the other deadline. So it was really fast. I mean, every night I would be like, okay, what poem do I need to write now? And then after it got submitted, then more poems were switched out. So it's hard to even say. I can point to like three or four and be like, oh yeah, that's been there the whole time. That's about it.
Yeah, it is funny the way that works, because I edit manuscripts for other poets and I'm just finished, I'm putting in quotation marks, I just finished my second manuscript, and you just write poems. Yay, I finished it. but you just write poems, and you write poems, and then when you start seeing a full collection come together, you have to now look at each poem, not just on its own terms, but how it functions in the manuscript. And have I used the word darkness in every single poem? Now can I maybe take that word and find something else instead? You know, you have to like now evaluate each poem as it relates to every other poem. And then it kind of feels like a snowball effect too, because like with you, Kelly, and all of these were about boats and had that theme running through them. And now you have to write a poem that uses the boat burn quote and is about burning a boat. So it's like I'm in that place with my own manuscript now because it's all about travel. And like I have so many travel quotes and quotes about what travel and seeing other places does for you. And now I'm like, I cannot finish this book until I've written a poem that includes this quote, and until that poem is written, none of the other poems are allowed to go out.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're coming to the end of our time, but I do actually want to ask one other question. This has been really helpful with the discussion about your first poem in the book, but I'm wondering about your editing process in general. So when you're not showing something to Jericho Brown and having him ask really insightful questions, what is your general process for editing? Do you have one?
I do. I do a number of different things. The first thing is, as I write, I am a very musical person, and I am like a self-proclaimed hater and non-believer of iambic pentameter. but I was told that I write with a lot of meter. When I write, I say it out loud constantly, and I go back and I tweak and I tighten and I tighten and I tighten. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of me writing three lines, tightening those three lines and moving on. And when I get to whatever a pause is in the writing process, I go back to the beginning and I tighten and I tighten and I tighten. So that's one thing, is I edit as I write, which some people are totally different. Another thing that I do that you have heard me talk about a lot in workshops, Tricia, is first thought, worst thought. Mm-hmm. So usually I try to say like, okay, here's the idea, and I'm going to think of three different riffs on that idea. For example, I have a poem that I wrote called And the Woman Said, and my idea was try to play around with language in that poem. So I remember there was a line that was about how like men smiling at women's breasts, and I was like, that sounds just so boring. So I was like, okay, smile. What do we have? Grin, toothy, tooth, who has a toothy grin, the Cheshire cat. So then the line became, when our breasts don't make them Cheshire cat the same. So thinking of an idea of something that's a common word or a common way to say it, and how can I choose phrases or wording or verbs or whatever it is that feel flat, and how can I make the language surprising? I am a huge proponent of the only reason I come to poetry, besides like needing company and emotional support, is for surprises in language. And I want to, whoa, I have never seen that before. I've never seen it described that way. I want to experience something new every time I come to the page. So I think in terms of editing, that's really important. And if you've ever heard anything describe a smile that way or the act of smiling, then highlight it and circle it and try to revise it.
Yeah. You know, and it's so different from the way that I write as well. But again, I know other writers who do that. They revise as they write. So that would be a really interesting exercise that I might have to try out, is like the next time I start a new poem, go back and revise every three lines and see how I can make it more interesting and more tight before I move on to the next three lines.
That's probably, now that I'm thinking about it, why I never know the end of a poem. Because I think that would be a great editing trick, is give yourself five lines or whatever. Yeah. The count is three, five lines, and not move on until those lines you feel like you could submit them right now, and then move on to the next three.
Okay.
And that's not to say that a writer can't have a perfect three lines right out of the gate.
Absolutely.
you don't have to revise every sentence. Sometimes they come out perfect.
Absolutely. And a lot of times I'll be like, oh, okay, these three lines are awesome. Those
right.
three lines are wah, wah. So yeah. I have to go back to those. But in that reading, I know where I can move on and where I need to stop.
That was so important, reading your work out loud. I'm shocked at how many writers don't do that.
Yeah.
It's so important.
You know, I have to confess, I don't usually do it until towards the end of the editing process. And I think a lot of it is because I just prefer to write in coffee shops and other places where it would be a little difficult to read my poetry out loud. And also, you know what I realized at one point? I was trying to write a poem by speaking it out loud first. And I realized I am so embarrassed hearing myself compose poetry and speak it before it's ready that I don't think, oh, now I have to challenge myself to try this too. I have so many little things to try after this interview, Kelly. So I have my work cut out for me for the week.
So your new book is coming out. This is your first debut book.
It is. It's a debut collection, and it will be out December 2nd, 2019 with Yes Yes Books called Boat Burned. And you can find more information about it, and it'll be available for pre-order in October. You can find more information about it, about me, about the Poetry Salon, kellygracethomas.com.
Excellent.
I'm also going to make a quick plug. If you have enjoyed listening to Armanet and Kelly and I talk about poetry and writing, we have a free, count it, free little mini series on YouTube that you can find. It's a 3-part series called How to Write with More Authenticity. Mm-hmm. And there's a writing prompt from me, a writing prompt based on one of Kelly's poems, and a writing prompt based on one of Armanet's poems. And I think 3 really useful writing prompts for getting yourself to write more authentically. So go ahead and check that out. And as always, you can find out more at thepoetrysalon.com. Armanet, Kelly, thank you both so much for being on this interview with us. And
thank you, Kelly, for joining us today. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, I love talking to you ladies.
All right, guys, girls, ladies, women, strong female, empowered boats. Go off sailing.
You have been listening to an interview of Kelly Grace Thomas. If you'd like to read the poetry of Kelly Grace Thomas, her book Boat Burned is available on pre-order from yesyesbooks.com at a 20% discount until its December 2 release. Paige Lewis, author of Spacestruck, says, "At the same time expansive and intimate, Kelly Grace Thomas's debut collection navigates issues of loss, family, and agency. Boat Burned invites us to witness pains and subsequent joys of rebirth. The boats that built me smoke on shore. Thomas's voice shines like a lighthouse beacon, guiding us through the difficult memories and toward the future's open waters."
Thanks to our sound editor and production manager, one-man tech department, Alan Rubenstein, for help on all things computer.
Remember, you can also check us out at thepoetrysalon.com or on the Poetry Salon's YouTube channel, where you can get access to selected poetry readings, prompts, recorded blog posts, and more.
If you want to stay in touch, ask us questions, or suggest a poet for us to interview, message us at Trisha@thepoetrysalon.com or Kelly@thepoetrysalon.com, or you can message us on our Poetry Salon Facebook page.
To help us spread the word about the Salon Cast and about poetry in general, subscribe, rate, and review us wherever you listen to podcasts.
You can also tell a friend, share this on social media, or hire a plane to write a message about us in the sky.
If you want to support our poetry community and get more support for your own writing, become a Patreon member.
That's right. For $1 a month on Patreon, we'll send you a new writing prompt with a new technique every week.
And for $5 a month, we'll give you an honest, useful, in-depth look at how we use the revision techniques we got on this podcast to rewrite our old drafts.
There is no guarantee what you'll see will be pretty.
Or finished.
Or free of typos.
But it will be honest. and you'll learn some fun new ways to get a fresh perspective on your old drafts. Until next time, SalonCast listeners, stay creative and remember, whoever writes the worst draft wins.
Yay!